Welcome to the World Vision Report. This week, in Mexico, illegal migrants make their way north on a train called the Beast.
Sometimes gangs will stop the train, make everyone get down and kidnap you. Then they call your relatives and demand a ransom to let you go.
And in Kenya, grannies show neighborhood thugs who's the boss.
While practicing, I encourage them not to smile. So I tell them to get serious because this is your life you are fighting for.
Plus, the new wave of Colombian musicians. And it's got nothing to do with Shakira. Around the world with the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. And we start the show this week with an all-too-familiar topic, gang violence and rape. But in this story, the women have figured out how to fight back. They're a group of grandmothers in Kibera, Kenya's largest slum, and they're often the targets of violence because they're older and appear frail or weak. But now, they've decided enough is enough, Emily Wong reports.
Inside a large, corrugated iron shack, 66-year-old Rayel Wairimu shouts as she pounds away at a large black punching bag. About 20 women between the ages of 60 and 90 will each get their turn. They've removed their shoes, but they wear long skirts, old oversized blazer jackets, and colorful wraps around their heads. And that word they're shouting as they punch the bag? Well, it's so important, it warrants special practice.
Sitaki means I don't want.
That's Sheila Kariuki, the self-defense instructor for this class of 22 grandmothers. They all live in a slum called Korogosho. And crime is so rampant here that women have to do more than simply scream to get help.
Most of the time they're attacked in the house. And when they say sitaki, sitaki, then the neighbor understands that there's something that is happening to her that she doesn't want. So they will be able to come to her rescue, unlike screaming.
Kariuki works for a small local charity here. She learned to be a self-defense instructor through an American-sponsored program called I'm Worth Defending. It targets slum communities like Korogosho, where more than 150,000 people are pressed into an area of less than 1 square mile. In the evenings, what is it like at night when it's dark?
At night, I would say there are so many cases of rape. So I would say at night, this place is really terrible. Yeah.
I noticed there's a young man to our left who's lying on the side of the street. He seems to be passed out on the side of the street. Is that common around here?
Yeah, it's really common because where we are just standing, there's a place that illicit brew is being sold at a very cheap price.
This is alcohol that's being brewed locally.
At around 7 in the morning, 8, they're just lying on the roads.
According to Kariuki, the availability of that cheap alcohol, as well as rampant drug use by young men here, make attacks against women more brazen. Back in class, the grandmothers are practicing simple moves that have maximum impact. Kicks to the knees and knees to the groin, as well as dizzying blows to the would-be attacker's temple. They aren't play fighting, but learning how to survive an attack.
While practicing, I encourage them not to smile, because when you smile, it's like you're smiling at the perpetrator. So I tell them to get serious, because this is your life you're fighting for.
At 90 years old, Marian Joke is the oldest student in the class, but she's surprisingly alert and agile.
Young men still see us as weak and very frail, and if we don't get these techniques, then we are still in danger. Every woman of my age should get these techniques because they're going to help her.
Njoke seems like no one to fool around with. As we watched, the 90-year-old used a classmate to demonstrate how to throw off an attacker if she's pinned down beneath him.
As he covers the mouth, the hands are free. Now she's going to pop the eyes
with her two fingers.
Yeah, with her two fingers.
Index and middle finger.
And then she will use her...
Her hips?
Her hips to swing and throw the man off balance and call for help.
And Njoke says she's put these defense skills to use.
I was scavenging at the dump site nearby looking for things to sell when a young man tried to touch my bottom. I gave him a hammer fist blow to the groin and called for help. Then people came from different directions and asked what was happening. When he heard this, he ran away.
68-year-old Beatrice Nyariara has recruited several friends, grandmothers like herself, to join the class. She wishes it had started earlier. It might have helped her friend Rhoda, who died in 2006. We worked side by side, she says, selling food. I saw her just the previous morning. The very next day, I heard she was raped and brutally murdered. The news was so painful. Kariuki says a few of these women are learning to become self-defense trainers for women in other Nairobi slums.
And everyone is going to recognize them as trainers who are not just coming somewhere to make noise and go home, but who can make an impact.
As one of the women put it, I used to be very fearful, but now I'm able to stand up for my rights. For the World Vision Report, I'm Emily Wong in Nairobi, Kenya.
Perfect. I love to show you how
Kenya's not the only country in Africa with a serious crime problem. For years, South Africa has had the dubious distinction of being called the crime capital of the world. It's had the world's highest murder rate, and incidents of rape have been out of control. That's why some soccer fans decided to stay home during this summer's World Cup. Turns out it wasn't as bad as they feared. Last week, the South African police released their latest crime statistics, and it appears the crime rate has fallen over the last year. Murder is down by nearly 9%, and that's the lowest level since the end of apartheid 16 years ago. Sexual assaults are also down by almost 5%. Authorities attribute some of the drop to new measures put in place in advance of the World Cup tournament. There are now extra policemen on the ground, quick-turn criminal courts, and better coordination among crime-fighting agencies. Crime affects everyone in South Africa, but it's the people who live in the townships and slums who are most often the victims. And for them, this is a trend in the right direction. In India, Hindus are gathering in homes and temples this week to celebrate the birthday of one of their most popular deities, a pot-bellied figure with an elephant's head and a long trunk. They call him Ganesha, the Hindu god of knowledge and success. Hindus pray to colorful plaster Ganesha statues, hoping they'll bring prosperity. But the workers who make these statues are struggling just to get by. Many of them live on the streets, surrounded by the statues they're creating. Jill Ryan stopped by a neighborhood in Ahmedabad, India, to meet some of the sculptors as they finished up their orders.
How many men does it take to move an 8-foot-tall, 900-pound elephant god?
It takes 6 of our people to carry a Ganesha statue, but otherwise you need 10 people. That's because we have practice and know how to lift the statue best.
That's 37-year-old Garpenby Chairman Bai Bharti. He's one of many artisans working on this bustling street, where workers toil to move one Ganesha to a nearby tent for painting. This heavy lifting comes after the workers have sculpted the plaster statues using wooden tools, and now the street's lined with hundreds of towering Ganeshas. They're crammed anywhere there's space, between workshops, tea stalls, around beds and cooking stoves, where the artisans live and children play. Some Ganeshas sit cross-legged, another reclines atop a serpent, one has turmeric-colored pants and red toenails. And all will be displayed in neighborhoods and temples for a 10-day festival when worshippers will ask Ganesha to end their unhappiness and misfortune.
Ganesha is our favorite god, because through him we can make a living.
Barty started sculpting when he was just 7, following in the footsteps of his father and grandfather. He's become well known for his statues, and he says even though he doesn't make much money, it's enough to care for his family and send his kids to school. But others here struggle. Members of the Jeta family are rushing to finish up their statues, and Mother Jemna Ben Jeta Solanki is making sure everyone stays focused. When her 21-year-old son takes a break, she quickly reminds him to get back to work. Solanki says the artisans have to buy their material before they know how much they'll sell, and that carries a lot of risk.
It's like a gamble. If you get orders, you get orders. Otherwise, you don't make money.
Like many of the women here, Solanki spends her days doing odd jobs, filling in holes in the plaster statues, or painting. It's the same kind of work her young grandchildren, that stand around her, will likely do by age 6 or 7, but Solanki would prefer they didn't.
They should do something else. We hope that they study well and move forward in their life. That would be good.
Down the street, 30-year-old Jagdish Marwari walks along a row of Ganeshas, spray-painting them a cotton candy pink. Marwari says that like many of the artisans here, he got started doing this work as a kid. And in his 2 decades of experience, he's seen the dark side of the business, like the long-term health effects of inhaling plaster and paint fumes every day.
Many of our people have gotten ill and then died. The doctor said this work is causing the problem. But if we don't do this labor, then what do we do?
Many workers here say they tire of the heavy lifting and constant manual labor. Some are getting older and can't make as many statues as before. One man said he couldn't even remember how long he'd been making Ganeshas, but he wished he could have done something easier. But there's also still a sense of pride here. As the Ganesha season comes to an end, and artisans add the finishing touches. A number of young men gather around a seated pink Ganesha as they place dime-sized silver and red sequins across his belly, followed with a layer of glitter. 19-year-old Gopal Bharti says he enjoys this part. There's a lot of physical exertion that goes into this work, he says, but we enjoy doing the colors and we use different lighting to make them stand out. Bharti signals to the others to flip on a series of tiny light bulbs molded into the statue's chest and arms. After a few tries, twinkling red, green, and white lights set the Ganesha aglow and bring smiles and a moment's rest to these young artisans. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jill Ryan in Ahmedabad, India.
There are photos of Ganesha statues on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Coming up, riding the rails with migrants to America. Stay with us for that.
Hi, I'm Jorge Derpich from La Paz, Bolivia, and you are listening to the World Vision Report.
I'm Peggy Waymire with the World Vision Report. Every day, hundreds of Central American migrants ride on top of Mexican freight trains bound for the U.S. border. A recent Amnesty International report estimates that thousands of them are assaulted and kidnapped every year. Children and teenagers often attempt the journey alone, risking their lives to find their mothers and fathers, who have already made it to America. Our reporter Grant Fuller hopped the train to give us this glimpse into the life of a teenage migrant. We begin in the small town of Arriaga in southern Mexico.
2 dozen people watch TV on the concrete patio of a church-run shelter. The migrants, a mix of men and women, young and old, slept here last night. Today, the mood is an awkward mix of relaxation and anxiety. That's because they're about to begin one of the world's most dangerous train journeys. One young migrant sits on a metal chair, away from everyone else. Jimmy Fajardo is 15 and alone. As he stares at the TV, a phone call comes into the migrant shelter office. They get word that the freight train they plan to hop is leaving today. Jimmy strolls out to the train tracks.
I just want to be up there with my family. That's what pushes me more than anything.
Here's the story Jimmy told me about his family. He says they left for the States without him years before. Then finally, 3 months ago, he decided to make this same train journey alone to reunite with his parents in Houston. Jimmy says he found them and had been painting houses with his dad. But just last week, according to Jimmy, he was stopped for underage driving and promptly deported. Now, he's determined to join his parents yet again. With his hair pulled back into a half ponytail and street smarts beyond his years, Jimmy looks as ready for the coming challenge as anyone. The freight train has arrived. Some people have already claimed their spot on top of the two rideable boxcars, the ones with flat metal grates running along the roof. The migrants hold on to them to keep from falling off, but that's their only protection. The train tops aren't meant to carry people, so there are no safety bars or anything to prevent someone from tumbling over the edge. Train crews routinely turn a blind eye to all this. Meanwhile, other migrants stock up on tortillas and cheese at a nearby store. Jimmy climbs the steel ladder and finds a spot for himself. He's ready to get moving, but he knows the journey won't be easy.
Sometimes gangs will stop the train, make everyone get down and kidnap you. They hit you and they force you to give them phone numbers. Then they call your relatives and demand a ransom to let you go.
More than 100 migrants are now on top of the two boxcars, waiting for their train to leave. Music drifts over from Arriaga's main plaza. Right behind Jimmy, an old man named Tonio keeps everyone entertained with a steady stream of jokes. After several hours of waiting, the train cars finally start rolling. Night has fallen, and it's a 12-hour ride from here to the next stop. Breezing past the hills of Chiapas, Jimmy figures it will take him 15 or 20 days to reach the U.S. border.
We have to stop at a bunch of places on the way, from here to Ixtepec, then Medias Aguas, Tierra Blanca, Veracruz, Orizaba, then over to Mexico City, from Mexico City to Celaya, then up to San Luis Potosí, Monterrey, and Nuevo Laredo, and that's where we'll end up.
From there, he plans to swim across the Rio Grande and find his parents in Texas. Jimmy carries a small backpack stuffed with pants, a sweater, and two pairs of socks. Thinking about what lies ahead, Jimmy lays out a textbook definition of the American dream.
In the United States, you have more freedom, you have a job, you make more money, so I think it's worth it to take this trip.
Once in a while, the train lurches forward, giving everyone a good jolt. A little boy at the back clings to his mother. But most people, including Jimmy, hardly bat an eyelid when the train jumps like this. Now on their second or third try after being deported from the U.S., they know the ropes. Nothing is a surprise. Watch out for the branches, someone shouts. Jimmy reflexively leans back flat against the boxcar roof as a bunch of tree limbs graze the top of his head.
I have to stay awake so I can keep watching the branches. They have thorns that can scratch you.
These freight trains that run the length of Mexico have earned the nickname La Bestia, the Beast. Because if you fall or get knocked off by a branch, you could easily get pulled under the wheels and lose a limb, or worse. And, as Jimmy mentioned, they've become a notorious target for kidnapping, assault, and extortion by local gangs and Los Zetas, one of Mexico's most feared drug cartels.
You have to be awake, watching all around you to make sure no one boards the train from below. It's not easy at all, because you get tired of sitting on these trains for so many days, always staying awake.
The train crosses into Oaxaca around midnight. That's when everyone notices the first sign that something might be wrong. I see some police lights over there, says Tonio, the old man who's been telling jokes. What's happening? Did the Zetas show up? Are we in trouble? No one is sure. The train zips past the siren lights of a police pickup truck. Nothing happens. A minute later, the same lights show up in a different spot up ahead. Then the truck speeds up to pass the train again. They're taking care of us, Tonio explains, because this area is full of criminals. Best anyone can figure, a recent spate of assaults along this stretch of track had prompted the Oaxacan police to provide a night escort for the train. Jimmy seems to relax a bit.
I think most of us feel safer because we've seen that the police keep watching over us. They keep an eye on how we're doing, and that doesn't happen often.
It doesn't last long either. The truck parks on a bridge over the tracks. As the migrants pass under and wave, they're on their own again. It's now the middle of the night, and Jimmy looks like he's finally given up on staying awake. Everyone is at least lying down, attempting to steal some rest. But the train is in the mountains now, and the temperature has dropped. Jimmy's having second thoughts about taking the night train.
Oh man, right now I'm like regretting this because I just took the first train I could catch, and because of the wind that's hitting us, it feels pretty cold, too cold, and it's impossible to sleep.
His voice is tired and hushed as he shivers atop the train. A moment later, the train slows to a crawl and then stops. One by one, bleary-eyed people get up to see what the problem is now. Are we there already? Someone wonders. Then two women with a bicycle cart roll over the grass alongside the train. They shout up to the migrants. We've got hot coffee and tamales, 3 for 10 pesos. How many do you want? They holler. It's a pre-dawn pit stop in a little Oaxacan village. But Jimmy stays put. He can't afford to buy tamales, so he'll hold out until he gets a free meal at the next shelter. As the train creaks back into action, the final stragglers climb aboard just in time. When the beast reaches full speed, Jimmy decides if he can't have coffee, he needs something to help him warm up. So he stands up on the moving train and tiptoes over half a dozen people, teetering dangerously close to the boxcar's edge. Then he disappears down the ladder and into the space between two cars. A few guys are riding on a tiny platform down there.
I really need to smoke because it's so cold, so I just had to go down there and see if one of those guys would sell me a cigarette. But it's scary because you could slip and fall.
Finally, around 10 o'clock, nearly 12 hours after this leg of the journey began, the beast grinds to a halt, and the migrants shuffle over to the ladder, single file. Jimmy hurries down and jumps into the weeds below. Everyone seems to know where to head next. They start walking down a dirt road to a migrant shelter run by the local Catholic church. In a weary voice, Jimmy grumbles about how bored he was up there and how hungry he is now. At the shelter, the migrants get in line for a hot bowl of goat stew from an outdoor kitchen. But Jimmy still refuses to eat. He doesn't like the looks of the meat, and his stomach feels a bit unsettled from the ride. So he stands nearby, munching on a piece of bread. Shelter volunteers ask each person a series of questions about the train ride. If anyone was assaulted on the way, they'll pass that information on to future migrants as a word of caution. Jimmy says the most treacherous part of the journey is yet to come.
In Orizaba, there are a bunch of tunnels, and sometimes the train stops inside the tunnel, so the smoke from the train suffocates you. I mean, we've got several more days of this, and sitting on top of this train is really tough.
Out in the shelter yard, Jimmy is shirtless as he leans over a wash tub.
I'm just taking advantage of my time here to wash some clothes. They say it's better not to be dirty so that people don't recognize you as a migrant.
Jimmy washes off last night's dirt and grime and prepares to do it all over again tomorrow when he'll hop another freight train headed north. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Ixtepec, Oaxaca, Mexico.
There are photos to go with this story. You can find them on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Many immigrants end up in really tough jobs here, picking fruit, doing construction, cleaning houses. Esperanza Perez works as a maid in a hotel. She's held the job for many years now, which might explain why she was singing when reporter Todd Melby checked in. Here's his reporter's notebook.
An expensive hotel is an oasis from reality. It's cloistered, air-conditioned, and perfectly manicured. Everything a person might need, food, entertainment, a place to sleep, is inside this bubble. On a recent trip to Phoenix for a conference, I stayed at a place that even had a fake waterfall. Everything was going fine. And then one afternoon, I headed up to my room, walked out of the elevator, and heard a faint voice. It was coming from inside one of the rooms. It belonged to a maid. I couldn't understand the words to her song. It was in Spanish, a class I'd nearly flunked in college. But it moved me. It lifted my spirits because it was so fresh, so human, so unexpected. I asked the maid if I could interview her. She said yes. So I grabbed my recorder, and we stood outside the room she was cleaning. I learned that Esperanza Perez is 44 and the mother of two adult children. For 13 years, she raised those kids alone. She did it by cleaning the rooms of people like me. I asked Perez if anyone ever requested that she not sing while she cleans.
Never, and never this time. I worked for a long time in the hotels, and every time the people told me, oh, this is so beautiful.
Do you always sing while you work?
Yeah, maybe more easy because they pass more faster the time and more happy for me, much better my job.
Just then, the guest who was staying in the room returned. Perez asked me to leave because she needed to work and didn't want any of the hotel customers to complain. When the door shut, my heart sank. I couldn't get Perez's sweet voice out of my head. So I went to the lobby and asked the manager for permission to interview her again. Perez's supervisor emerged and noted that cleaning personnel weren't allowed in the lobby, but I could, if Perez agreed, talk to her in the employee break room after her shift ended. The rule, the one about maids being barred from the lobby, surprised me. I'd never thought of that before. But how could I not have known that? I'd stayed at lots of fancy hotels and never, ever seen a maid in the lobby or any other public place. After Perez's shift, I met her in the break room, located in the hotel basement. While another employee warmed up a meal in a microwave, I recorded Perez singing again, this time without interruption.
Preguntale a la noche si ha visto alguna vez.
Todd Melby is a reporter based in Minneapolis.
En una misma piel.
If you've jumped into a cab in New York City recently, you probably had a driver who wasn't from the city, or even the country. Most of New York City's taxi drivers are immigrants from countries like India, Russia, or Haiti, and most of them are here to stay. But for many of the 200 Ghanaians who drive cabs in New York City, the goal is to go home, Anna Boyko-Wyrock reports.
So how is business today?
Not that good, but not that, you know.
George Asari is a veteran of the streets of New York. The Ghanaian immigrant has been driving a cab for 17 years. Today, he's cruising Manhattan for fares.
This business is always luck. It's always luck. You never know what job is coming your way after maybe a couple of hours. So you always have to take it easy and, you know, just have the patience and keep on driving.
Taxi drivers get to set their own hours. So for immigrants like George, driving a yellow cab is a good way to get an education and send money home at the same time. He already got his bachelor's here. Now he wants to go to grad school for business. He says this job helps him invest in his future.
I would say majority of the people have the same idea that, hey, listen, let me come to America, take advantage of the opportunities here, work very hard, get education, and then see if one day I can go home and retire back home.
Outside the cab, it starts to drizzle. That's good for business. Pretty soon, a customer hops in.
26th Street and Madison Avenue.
Sure, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Sometimes, passengers are really friendly.
What is this, a brand new cab?
To be honest with you, this cab is almost 1.5 years.
Get out, really?
Yeah, my partner and I, we have done almost...
But not all trips go so smoothly. Taxi drivers have a lot of horror stories about customers making things difficult. Edward Owusu is from eastern Ghana, and he's been driving a cab on and off for 15 years. One time, a teenager gave him bad directions to Times Square. He knew she was wrong, so he told her they had to take a different way.
As soon as I said that, she's like, yeah, you come from Africa, you're going to tell me what to do. I was born here. Da, 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 da. When I get to Times Square, she tear off the $10 bill. She tear it off into two and threw it in the cab and jump out and started running. That is very disrespectful.
Wow, so it sounds like taxi drivers face so much disrespect.
I mean, it's like nobody want to hear our part of the story.
Which is one reason a group of Ghanaian immigrants formed the Ghanaian Taxi Drivers Association 3 years ago.
One time we were in a restaurant, that, you know, African restaurant that we all love.
Anthony Appiah is one of the founding members.
It dawned on us that we have to do something about ourselves, you know. So we decided to come together.
This is one of the group's monthly meetings, held at a community center in the Bronx. The association helps members with practical matters, like getting a business license and workmen's compensation. But it offers more than that. The group's got their back, which is especially important for people who left their entire family in Ghana. Back in his cab, George Asari says one time, a member wasn't answering his phone for 3 days. The group sent another taxi driver to check up on him.
So he went there, he knocked on the door, and he wasn't responding. So the super and then my friend, they broke into his apartment and he was in coma. He has a diabetes, but he didn't know. So he went to diabetic coma. So very lucky that we were there to save his life.
George says taxi drivers also help their home country. Last year, they raised money for hospital supplies in Ghana. As another longtime cabbie, Charles Anochu, points out, helping each other is just what Ghanaians do.
It's our culture. It's part of our culture that we get ourselves together. In case of any emergency, we help ourselves.
The association hopes one day to build its own community center and expand its philanthropy back in Ghana. For the World Vision Report, I'm Anna Boyko-Warak in New York City.
And if you happen to be in one of those Ghanaian cabs, you might hear this hot new sound from the home country. It's called One Life from the debut album My Time, released last week in Accra by rising star Iwan Ghana. So many things to follow, yo. But my life is borrowed and I can afford to live in a sorrow. I know where I'm coming from, can't call me the prodigal son. Next on the World Vision Report, immigrants bring a taste of home to Minneapolis. Stay with us. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. When Khunroth Lam was just a little girl, she lived through one of the most brutal regimes the world has ever known. In the 1970s, nearly 2 million Cambodians died during the reign of the Khmer Rouge. Khunroth Lam and her parents survived, but barely had enough food to eat. Lam got through these tough times by dreaming of the delicious meals her grandmother prepared for her in happier moments. One dish appeared in her dreams more often than others. It was her absolute favorite, plier salad. Lam is now a resident of the U.S., and she's making plier for customers at her restaurant in St. Paul, Minnesota. Mary Stuckey paid her a visit.
Khunroth Lam takes such joy in cooking. Perhaps it's because she's trying to make up for lost time.
During the communists, it was starving, and then now I make food for everybody to eat.
On this day, in her restaurant near downtown, Lam is getting ready to cook her signature dish, plier salad. First, she assembles the many ingredients, thinly sliced beef tenderloin, grated carrot, red and green bell pepper, bean sprouts, basil, mint, spring onions. Then there's a green leaf Lam calls papel.
You can smell it. It tastes really good.
Can I try it?
It's spicy taste and it tastes really good.
Completely fresh. Yeah, little bit of a cilantro, but not cilantro.
Not cilantro. Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Once all the ingredients are ready, Lam sautés the lean beef strips in a hot, dry skillet. No oil, which makes this dish especially healthy.
I'm just sautéing the beef with lime juice and then on a hot wok. So that's how we do it. Salt, sugar, to make it more taste, not just so
bring
bland.
Bring
the taste up, yeah.
And then she adds the sauce. Plier is not plier without the special sauce.
It has vinegar, sugar, garlic, pepper, and fish sauce.
After the beef cools down a bit, Lam puts the sauce and all the other ingredients into a metal bowl and mixes gently. Then she puts the mixture onto a plate with a little rice and sprigs of mint.
When you eat, you have to pick some of the mint leaf while you eat. It tastes good. Okay. Yeah, refreshing, yeah.
The flavor is really good.
You can taste the different ingredient every bite you eat.
It's exactly true. With every bite you take, it's a slightly different flavor.
Yeah. It's complicated, this food, isn't it?
It is complicated to make it, but when you make it, you cannot stop eating it.
Perhaps because it is so complicated, this is a dish Cambodians make for special occasions like weddings and birthdays. But for Khunrath Lam, the most special occasion for eating pleer came after the murderous Khmer Rouge was finally driven out of power. Lam made her way back to the house where she had grown up in the capital of Phnom Penh. One by one, other family members joined her.
My grandma was so happy to see some of the children that survived come to visit her. So she made this pleer salad for us to eat. And then I remember that on celebration. Yeah, happy time together. So wonderful.
They were happy to be back together. But eventually, Lam's family fled Cambodia, ending up in a refugee camp just over the border in Thailand. After years in the camp, a stroke of good luck. A church in St. Paul offered to sponsor the family. They arrived on a snowy November day in 1983. Lam opened her restaurant 13 years ago and introduced people in Minnesota to Cambodian cuisine.
My customer, like my family, I feel like they are my family. That's why I cook for them, feel from my heart.
The name of Lam's restaurant is Cheng Heng. Cheng is the middle name of Lam's husband. Heng means lucky. It's a fitting name for her restaurant because Khunrath Lam considers herself to be very lucky indeed. For the World Vision Report, I'm Mary Stuckey in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Now we head to Colombia. Until fairly recently, the country was terrorized by drug cartels and paramilitary groups. A government crackdown has turned that around. Security has improved, and so has the economy. And that's helped fuel a new musical boom in Bogota, and it's reaching us here in the U.S. National Geographic's world music expert Tom Pryor joins us now. Tom, great to speak with you again.
Good to speak to you.
Before we jump into some of this music, I'm wondering if you can just paint a picture for us. What is happening in Bogota that's leading to this current outcropping of musicians?
Essentially, what's going on is you've got the generation that were sort of younger teenagers during the rock and Espanol explosion of the 90s coming into their own. And what they're doing is they're not just playing rock and Espanol anymore, but they're really doing their homework and digging into Colombia's roots music. They were raised on rock and on hip-hop in the 90s. And they've taken these sort of outside influences and reincorporated Colombian roots music, especially cumbia and music called champeta, which are both music from Colombia's Pacific coast, and really taken them to interesting new places.
Do you think some of this new interest and rise in music and new bands coming to the forefront has to do with the whole drug smuggling being cleaned up somewhat in Colombia? I mean, has this freed people up to be more creative and pay more attention to things like music?
I would say that's part of it, but that's certainly not the whole story because, I mean, don't forget, even in the midst of the worst of the drug violence, Colombia was still putting out huge superstars like Juanes and, of course, Shakira. I'm sure this has had an impact on it. I'm sure the safety factor, but there's still, you know, street crime is still a factor. Unemployment is still very high. I think it's about 12%. I would say the real factor actually is Colombia's economic improvement in terms of currency fluctuations. The Colombian currency is actually much more valuable than it was compared to the dollar just a few years ago. And that's enabling these groups to really tour outside of the country.
Interesting. You mentioned Shakira and Juanes. What is different about the sound of these new groups?
Well, what's different is Shakira and Juanes, they were coming at it from a pop place. They were doing what's often called in Colombia, tropipop. And I'd say that these bands are coming from a slightly different place. Their sound is a little rawer, a little bit rougher. You know, Shakira, I think, is very conservative, musically speaking, whereas these bands really embrace electronica and a whole lot of somewhat out there sounds. And as a result, I think their music is a lot fresher and a lot more creative.
What would you like to start with that would best illustrate the new sound coming out of Colombia?
I think I would go with Bomba Estéreo. 11, 10,
9, ignition sequence.
You could hear that loping bass sound. That's cumbia. That's real traditional Colombian cumbia, which, you know, cumbia has been exported all over Latin America, and there's a really well-known Mexican variant, and there's bands from Argentina that play it now, and it's been revived and diced and sliced a million ways. What they're doing is they're adding in this dub element, the sort of Jamaican element to it, and then also crossing it with champeta music, which is a traditional Afro-Colombian sound from the city of Palenque on the Pacific coast.
What is champeta?
Champeta is a sound from the city of Palenque in Colombia, but it's a very African sound. It's Afro-Colombian music at its sort of most African, and very much influenced by a lot of African pop music. And there, you know, it's been around for decades, but there was a sort of recent revival. And a lot of, like, you know, Colombian hipsters always thought of it as sort of lower class music, but it's in recent years it's been sort of revived and repackaged and really thought of as hip.
There is a very large Afro-Colombian community, descendants of slaves that the Spaniards brought over. Tell us a little about their culture and their lives in Colombia.
The Pacific Coast is historically underdeveloped compared to the bigger cities. And the African communities, or the Afro-Colombian communities, I should say, are the most underdeveloped of all. That said, they've had a real disproportionate impact on Colombian music. I mean, you know, cumbia, for instance, which is probably one of the best-known Colombian musics for decades, really has its roots in African music. And champeta is a more recent phenomenon, and it's considered a little bit more street, maybe a little bit more ghetto, a little bit, you know, it's not really something that you would play in a salon.
I want to talk about another group that's getting a lot of attention in this country and around the world, and they are Afro-Colombian themselves from the Pacific Coast, and it's called Choqib Town. Tell us a little about this group.
There are three rappers that comprise the sort of brain trust of the band. There's a larger group as well that plays behind them that incorporates traditional instruments like tambores, which is a big drum, and you know, everything from that to laptops. And I first saw them two years ago, at South by Southwest, and they were phenomenal. Just so high energy, and they've been around, and they're currently on tour in Europe right now, and they're currently based out of Bogota because they had to go there to sort of make a living, really. But they do come from the Pacific Coast, and they come out of, as I was saying before, some of these bands come out of the rock and Espanol generation. Well, these guys actually come out of the Latin rap generation, so they're also coming out of a sort of international music space and then going back into their own heritage, which is this music from the Pacific Coast, and really, you know, fusing the two together in this really unique sound.
Well, this definitely does have a modern sound, but you've said they also use some traditional instruments.
Well, the flute sound you hear in there, although it's a sample, is a traditional Colombian instrument called, I think, a raita. And one of the drums you're hearing, that sort of booming bass drum sound in there, that's a tambor that they actually have live on stage when they play. So that's a very good example of how they sort of fuse traditional Colombian elements into a very modern sound.
La calle o la casa del music. a great look at some of the good music coming out of Bogota right now. Thanks so much for sharing it with us, and I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Thanks, Peggy. It's always fun.
Tom Pryor writes about world music for National Geographic magazine. Y llegué a pensar que el amor todo lo podía acabar. Pero llegaste tú, tú y tú, y me dijiste: no, 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 no. La música no es para ti. Esa estrella está lejos de ti. Si sigues así, aquí no podrás vivir. La calle o la calle. Earlier in the show, reporter Grant Fuller took us on a train ride with a teenage migrant called Jimmy. Jimmy was on top of a freight train traveling the length of Mexico to get to the United States and his family. You might have wondered how Grant got that story, with harrowing details of riding the top of a train. Well, Grant jumped the train too and filed this reporter's notebook about his experience.
I'll admit it, I was a little bit scared of the beast. I mean, a freight train doesn't get that kind of nickname for nothing. As I waited for the train with dozens of Central American migrants, I looked for someone who could help me stay safe, someone who'd been on the train before. I had three choices of willing volunteers: a tattooed Chicano ex-con from L.A., a teenager who worked at the migrant shelter, and a frail old man. None of them quite fit the bill. So I went for Plan B, make friends. But I was told to be careful, that you never know who the bad guys are. I found a few people I could trust and formed something of a team. On the train, I stayed close and relied on them to watch out for me. The train ride itself was uneventful, considering the stories I'd heard. I was later told that my 12-hour stint on the train was the safest section of the entire journey. My experience was much the same as Jimmy, the teenager I was following. Holding on when the train lurched, taking tree branches to the head, and freezing on top of the boxcar with metal bars digging into my side. Needless to say, it was a long night. When we reached our destination that morning, I stood up to record. Then, suddenly, the slow-moving beast changed direction. It was headed back the same way we just came from, and it was picking up speed. All my new friends were already safely on the ground. I tried not to panic, but I knew I had to get off that train. I nervously waited my turn to get down. With headphones around my neck and cables hanging everywhere, I scaled the ladder. The wheels churned faster and faster beneath me. I'd heard of many migrants being amputated or killed this way. How do they do this in the movies? I thought. With another migrant yelling at me, I kind of twirled off the ladder and jumped backwards, taking a clumsy tumble into the weeds. Making sure I was still in one piece, I caught up to the rest. They were shaking their heads.
Whew, casi me fui.
You jumped off the wrong way, Jimmy said. When you jump off backwards like that, you're gonna fall.
No, está bien. Sobreviví.
Well, I survived, I said with a sigh of relief. And I was relieved for another reason, too. I was catching a bus back to my apartment in Mexico City. I was done. But these guys had more trains, more danger, and more uncertainty ahead. They were nowhere near home free.
Grant is now back home in Mexico City, and he took some time out to attend a big party. On September 15th, Mexicans celebrated 200 years of independence from Spain. Mexico City threw a huge fiesta. Grant Fuller had a rooftop perch for the show, and he recorded this audio postcard of Mexican President Felipe Calderón's grito, or battle cry of independence. That that's it for this week. Remember, if you're interested in knowing what stories are in the show each week, you can find out. Just go to our website, worldvisionreport.org, and sign up for our weekly email. Each Monday, you'll get an email from us with a heads up about interesting features in that week's show. You can also sign up for a podcast there and read blogs from reporters around the world. The address again, worldvisionreport.org. The show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is the engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is the production assistant. I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
Conocí primero, pareces amapolita de las costas de Guerrero. Ay, yo quisiera y más quisiera que la mujer que yo quiero quiera a Dios que a mí me quiera. Sirana y naná, sirana y naná, sirana y naná.